vice presidents.
Fred Forsher was one, and Len Pepkowitz was the other one.
Right.
And Len Pepkowitz was a competent chemist. Mm-hmm. And Fred, of course, came in as an architect. I mean, that was his background. Mm-hmm. Neither of them were able to stand up to Shapiro, and Shapiro just had the attitude that he knew everything. And that led to an unpleasant and unhealthy atmosphere. As a matter of fact, it eventually led to the demise of the company.
Yes, what were they making? What were their products?
We were making a ceramic-grade uranium dioxide that went into the pellets, fuel pellets. They were the fuel pellets of power reactors, of pressurized
nuclear
water.
Nuclear power reactors.
Yeah, pressurized water nuclear power reactors.
It's for the, any for the Navy?
I can't remember hardly any Navy work. The Navy work was all done at Bettis.
Yes.
But Bettis was, of course, a division of Westinghouse. And, in fact, it was run by and financed by the Navy. But we were civilian atomic power, and we made zirconium rods, and a number of specialized kinds of fuels, carbide fuels. But the big thing we cranked out in quantity was ceramic-grade uranium dioxide pellets, fuel pellets.
Mm-hmm. Enriched.
Enriched, definitely enriched.
Yeah.
We went anywhere from 2.3% up to full enrichment.
Mm-hmm. To full enrichment?
Full enrichment. We went up to full enrichment.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And of course, there were lots of problems with this. I mean, there were criticality problems to be observed. Criticality is the propensity of nuclear. Well, I'm trying to explain for purposes of, you know, you're not the only person that's going to be listening to this, I'm assuming. Or we may be wasting our time, but criticality is the propensity of this material to reach power level. And in fact, in nuclear power reactors, you bring them to just barely critical, and that's the level at which they give out power. And critical means that they reach a self-sustaining reaction. Of course, if you ever achieve criticality by accident, it'll blow itself apart pretty fast, but in so doing, a flash of radioactivity will kill whoever's standing beside it.
But that never happened at Lubeck.
No, that never happened at Lubeck. I can remember, for instance, having a truck come in with armed escorts, front and rear, bringing in these casks, these coffins of fully enriched uranium, and signing off for millions of dollars worth of fully enriched uranium. Maybe, just guessing, maybe 16, 18, 20 casks. And the order in which you moved these things out of the truck and moved them into storage became quite important, because the array of these casks and these chunks of uranium, fully enriched uranium, possibly could go critical.
Yeah. So, do you remember that they made tried to make artificial heart pacemaker?
Any of that stuff? Incidentally, they later opened the Parks Township thing, which dealt with plutonium.
That was a different thing.
Right. That was different.
I didn't know.
And I had nothing to do with that. And in fact, I think they did do some pacemaker work there.
Mm-hmm.
But we never did any in Apollo, in the Apollo
plant,
which was the main plant. Mm-hmm. So anyway, coming back to the situation, we were now about to design and build a really large-scale plant to convert uranium hexafluoride into ceramic-grade UO2. Do this on what was a big scale for that kind of operation. And
UF6, just like that. UF6 instead of
uranium hexafluoride is UF6.
I put a line here.
Just UF6. That's good enough.
It was... I was in charge of designing this thing. Mm-hmm. And there were a number of keys to the design. One of them was to make a very large kiln for UF2. And I knew that we did not have the resources to design one of those things, first crack out of the box and make it work. And it was ridiculous for us to try. So I brought in a fellow that I had, I called in Bartlett Snow Pacific, who were probably the biggest company in the United States, if not the world, in building kilns at that time.
Got the UF6 from Mallinckrodt, you remember?
UF6 came to us from Portsmouth, Ohio. The Portsmouth plant was operated by Goodyear. Mm-hmm. And when I was running the plant that was making UO2, I would call up, his name slips my mind at the minute, but I'd call up the plant manager at Goodyear and say, Art, forget his last name, we need a shipment and we need it next Tuesday. Mm-hmm. This is the enrichment and this is how much I want. So, you know, we worked hand in glove that way. At any rate, so I was working with Bartlett Snow on this plant and superimposing our specifications, which were highly special, on this thing. And we were working together on it. I knew what we had to do to meet our requirements, and they knew what they had to do mechanically to put this thing together, to fabricate it, put it together. And it was working fine. All of a sudden, Zalman came into the picture and he said, we're going to design and build our own. And I said, Zalman, that isn't feasible. It doesn't make sense. We don't have the hands to do that. We don't have the experience to do it. We don't have the skills to do it. And why should we do it when we get the best in the country, if not the world, to do it for us? And he insisted, and we got into quite an argument. And finally, he said, that's what we're going to do. And I said, Zalman, you don't need an engineer. What you need is a yes man. At that point, I decided I had enough of Zalman. I was going to bide my time until I decided where I was going to go. And I was out of it.
You decided to quit. What year was that?
That was sometime in 1961, mm-hmm. and I didn't get all my ducks in order till the following year. But mm-hmm. at any rate, I was—I mm-hmm. had made the mental commitment, and I was yes. from there on gone. We also had another problem. We had these tanks in which we—I say tanks—they were 10-inch, very tall cylinders made of plastic, and they were contained 10-inch because 10 inches is critically safe for anything under 5% enrichment. And these were storage tanks for uranium-containing materials. And try as I would, I could not figure out a layout arrangement within the space that we had inside that building that was not critical. And I came back to Shapiro and I said, look, the only thing I know about criticality is following the cookbook on it. Following the cookbook, I can't make this happen. Mm-hmm. You have Carl Nepschel up there, who is supposed to be a nuclear physicist. He's an expert in this. Get Carl to lay it out. Well, Zalman insisted, oh, yes, that can be done. So he had Carl working on it. And, of course, Carl never laid it out. It never happened. So finally, this plant had to go into a substantially larger space than had ever been figured. But according to Shapiro, that wasn't going to happen either. As all of these disasters began to take shape, I finally got to the point where I was ready to leave and go do my thing. And that's what I did. So I left there with a very light heart.
With a light heart?
Yes, indeed. Mm-hmm. I felt that was it.
Yeah, I'm very pleased that you gave us that story, because you're discussing an important area event in relation to a person that we had no substantial experience fact on. You know, everything was generalities like that. Go ahead.
The plant later got into very serious financial problems. And
who got into the serious financial?
You make it.
Yeah, that's a different story.
Yeah. And
that's a different story.
There was a fellow named Ryan who was running RIDC,
yeah.
And Shapiro had to go to Ryan.
Yeah, that's a different story.
But anyway, that's a long story.
Yeah.
That's beside the point.
You've given me the story I wanted.
Mm-hmm. So, when I left UMAC, I had decided to go into consulting.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt at that point that Shapiro was one of my very best friends, because he had finally given me the mental push to do what I wanted to do in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
And in a peculiar sort of way, I've always been grateful to Shapiro for doing that.
Mm-hmm.
Because he made me realize what a travesty working for a corporation can be. And, you know, and I had seen evidences of this kind of thing in other corporations that I've worked for. I may have mentioned my first job at Elliott Company. I remember one fellow being called back from vacation to be fired, someone who'd worked there for 20-some years, and another fellow, young man, who got married and bought a house, and his boss knew all this was coming along, and he knew he was about to be fired, and they fired him. You know, you see these things in the course of working for corporations, and you realize that whatever happens on your own, at least it's of your own making. It's of your own making. So it's a good place to be, in spite of all the problems that there are with it and the difficulties. It's...
As long as you're talking in that vein, the good part of work, the problems of working in a corporation, the when you work essentially, when you're self-employed as a consultant, is for one company and another job and another job, don't you get the notion that, where do I get my credit from? Where is my... it's like a prostitute. You're doing a job, it's a good job here, and it's a good job on the next one, but there's no connection between them.
You know, it's interesting that you should call it a prostitute, because you're independent and working for a number of companies. Someday you and I will have to get into a discussion of why that is more prostitute than working for one company, and having to knuckle under to every decision that company makes.
You're answering the implied question.
Actually, there's... prostitution has to do with doing something that you feel is wrong.
Mm-hmm.
I'll give you an example.
Mm-hmm.
I got a call one day from a...
That was the wrong word that I used.
Never mind. I got a call one day from a company in Driftwood, PA. Now, you may never have heard of Driftwood. You may not realize that this is an important crossroads in the bear hunting part of the country of Pennsylvania, of Upper Pennsylvania. But at any rate, he had an interesting job. He had gotten, I've been referred to him, and in a very flattering sort of way. So he wanted me to come up and visit him, and I did. And you know, it was a drive way into God's country. It takes about 3.5 hours to get there. And I got up and sat down in his office, and he explained to me, by the way, he had it, he was getting scrap copper telephone wire and connectors from a subsidiary of Bell, of AT&T. And he was making electrolytic grade copper, which involved taking off the insulation, taking off the tinning, and so forth. And in so doing, you're running quite a chemical factory, because there's a lot of stuff that comes off of it. And what he wanted to do was to take the vinyl chloride insulation and cook it and make hydrochloric acid. And I asked him how much, what kind of tonnage he was running through there, and he told me, and I laughed. And I said, well, you have a little problem. You know, hydrochloric acid is a bulk commodity. I mean, people don't make hydrochloric acid in pounds. They make it in thousands of tons, and you're nowhere near that kind of thing, and you just go broke trying to do that. And he got to be very insistent. And so I stood up and I smiled at him and I said, I only know that if I undertook to do this, you and I would not wind up being friends. My advice to you is don't do it, but in any event, I won't do it. Mm-hmm. And I got up and started to walk out. He said, wait a minute, what would you do? And I said, that's a different question. And that started a relationship in which eventually I built a plant for him, which was a byproduct plant with a lot of things. That's a whole other story. I was trying to develop a way to recover gold.
This was after you established yourself
in consulting.
In the independent consulting.
Yes.
Right. Where were you working from? Your house? And where was that?
Well, initially I started working from my house. And at that time we were living at the corner of Tilbury and Nicholson.
Yes.
And we had just finishing our basement off as a playroom for the kids. Actually, I guess Julie was a couple years old. It was 1962 when I
yes.
started into consulting. And so, you know, we had this rather nice basement as far as the playroom was concerned. So I just took the whole darn thing over as an office. That lasted for a year or so until we bought this house, in fact. And then, at that time, I took over the whole third floor, and I've had as many as 8 or 9 people working here at different times.
You had as many as 9 people working in the attic of this house?
They weren't all there. Some of them were down in the basement. I had draftsmen working on the plants in the basement, and I had engineers up there, and I said, this won't do, this is too much, so I went out and bought a building. But that came along a little later. I'm trying to get this back on some kind of track that makes some sort of sense. And anyway, I started to tell you about this particular company, so I may as well proceed with that story for the moment, even though that isn't the starting point of my consulting career. The company was called Metal Wire Recovery Corporation. And they had a process. Well, actually, the first thing they were doing is they were taking copper wire and they were burning the insulation off in open fields, which the state Department of Environmental Resources was always after them and was going to shut them down and so forth and so on. So they had to build a plant to do this. And they had another facility in which they were cooking the insulation off. And that was very crude. It was a very messy, sloppy, stinking operation. But I wasn't working in that part of it. I was off to one side taking these connectors and trying to develop a way to recover gold and precious metals out of it. And one night the telephone rang, and I sat up and I looked, and it was 3 o'clock in the morning. And I picked up the telephone, and I'm trying to remember his name. The president of the company was on the phone. And he said, the plant is burning. It's almost burned down. You've got to come up here right away this morning. You've got to build me another plant. And I had nothing to do with this plant. I didn't know anything about it or what they were doing. So I went back to sleep, and the next morning I drove up, and I looked at the smoldering ruins of this disaster. And first of all, they have no records of anything. Their only chemist was a high school youngster who was acting in kind of a control laboratory. They had no procedures. Nothing. Nothing was written. Nothing was anywhere. So I made a series of visits, and I interviewed all the people in the plant to find out what the devil it was they did. And then I went around and I collected samples of stuff that hadn't burned. And I talked to this young chemist to find out, actually he wasn't a chemist, I mean, he was working in the chem lab, but he was just a technician. So I got kind of a picture pieced together, and I realized, of course, we could not build a plant of that sort again. We couldn't build it because it was no good.
Yeah.
It was just, yeah. You know, talk about an environmental mess. Yeah. This was real garbage. So, are we all right?
Yeah, we're all right for the moment.
Okay. First thing I did was to rent a garage, somebody's automobile garage, because I could get one right nearby. And I bought all the equipment to equip it as a laboratory. And I took all these samples, brought them into this young man, and I wrote him out a series of procedures, and I told him what I wanted him to do. He was to do a series of tests and get me data. And then I went off and began to explore how to handle this material. And, you know, whether I wanted to try and do a continuous or batch continuous, how I wanted to handle it. And I did a halfway design both ways, and I finally decided that doing it full continuous was just virtually impossible. I mean, it was the wrong scale to do it on.
Yeah.
Just the wrong scale. So I scraped out something that looked like a batch continuous plant. I remember his name. It was Alan Levin. And Alan wanted me to design a pilot plant for him. And I thought about this for a while, and I said, Alan, I think I can design this first crack out of the box and make it work.
Hmm.
And I said, if it were my plant, this is what I would do, because first of all, I would save the cost of building a pilot plant.
Mm-hmm.
Your full-scale plant isn't that much bigger than a pilot plant.
Mm-hmm.
In the second place, I would be back in production while you would still be fiddling with the pilot plant. But I want a piece of paper from you that says no matter what goes wrong in this thing, you will sue it to have any legal recourse. So if you want me to do that,
mm-hmm.
we'll take the risk together. So he agreed, and that's what I did.
Mm-hmm.
And I built this plant, and most of it worked about as planned. Golly, the fun I had trying to put people together on a part-time basis to get this. The design was very special in many ways. For instance, we had a big carbate condenser on this thing. It wasn't a tubular condenser. It was the kind that was put together with blocks. There was a lot of very special stuff in this. And, you know, it was just absolutely first of a kind. Nobody's right mind would dream of a thing.
Well,
like
it was
this.
A recovery plant. It was not a took scrap material. How secure was this material, his source?
Oh, very secure. He virtually had a license to print money.
Yeah, of course.
And in the long run, he messed it up.
Mm. Okay, let's let that story go, I guess.
Well, no, it's an interesting story because I was involved in this, and I kept trying to educate this guy into how to run a plant. And what could happen? The plant, by the way, we didn't rebuild the plant in Driftwood. We built it in Danville, PA.
Mm-hmm.
He got a good deal from the local and so forth. And so I used to fly up to Williamsport And I'd fly up in the evening and rent a car and drive to Danville. By the time I'd get to Danville, it was outside of Danville, really. By the time I'd get there, it'd be 12 or 1 o'clock in the morning. And I would go straight to the plant. And I'd walk in, and nobody ever questioned me. Nobody ever asked me what I was doing. So I'd walk around, and I'd talk to all the operators and find out what they were doing and what their problems were. And I would walk in to Alan's office in the morning, and I'd have a list this long of all the things that were wrong and all the things that needed to be corrected. And somehow he never ever managed to get a manager who would walk out of the office and into the plant, as a result of which it just, the situation got progressively worse. And in spite of all of these lists and all of the ideas and everything that went into it, they couldn't run it. They just didn't understand how to run a plant. And somehow or other, they weren't about to learn. Not only that, Alan eventually got tied up with the local bankers, who he felt were a bunch of rubes because they lived in Williamsport, but he was a city boy. And they took him to the cleaners. So that went away. But as a plan and as a design and as a person of fact, he was highly successful. Just unfortunate that it didn't fall into the right hands.
You did a good job as far as the engineering of the plant design is concerned. Nevertheless, the plant did not have like extended tenure. Okay, what was another job?
Well, the very first really important job I got. I left New Make in March, and at that time I had absolutely zero prospects, no clients, no job, no work, and I had two small kids. And I went around and introduced myself all around the countryside. A lot of people knew me from one thing or another.
Yeah, you've been around 10 years.
We've been around from engineering, actually 15. From engineering societies or contacts that I had made in one direction or another. And I had all kinds of job offers. Everybody wanted to hire me, but nobody had any consulting work.
Yeah.
And I wasn't about to be hired again.
Yeah.
So I remember I would set a target of seeing maybe six people a day scattered all over the countryside, and I would come home dog-tired at night, and eventually Marcia asked me, do you really think there's a market for what you're doing?
Mm-hmm.
She was very supportive, and she made it as easy as
possible. Was she working?
No. As a matter of fact, when we got married, Marcia had a job when we got married. And I said, you know, in a little while the kids will come along and you'll be tied down and you'll be busier than you wanted. Why don't you just take time off and enjoy yourself, and relax, and so forth? Probably one of the biggest mistakes I ever made, because that didn't really, you know, Marcia did that. Taking for granted that that was a certain kind of wisdom, but in her case it was just the wrong kind of wisdom, because she had to be occupied and she had to be doing things and creating and supervising and all of those good things. So she found lots of outlets for her energy, but at any rate, so once in a while she would ask me if I thought there was really any market for this, and I was convinced that there were a lot of companies out there who really couldn't maintain my kind of talent on a full-time basis. First of all, they couldn't pay for it. Second, they couldn't interest it. They couldn't keep that kind of support. And they didn't need it all the time. They needed it on an off-and-on basis. And that's where I came in. But I made one mistake. My mistake was that I thought that the big market for this would be with the small companies. who really couldn't touch that kind of talent. And that turned out to be wrong because the small companies had no idea what to do with it. And from working from outside a company, you have to have counterparts inside the company that you can work hand in glove with if you're going to do anything. Mm-hmm. And I'm not talking about the kind of consulting where you walk in, you do a study, you hand in a report, stroke your gray beard, and walk out the door. When I walked into a plant, I made things happen. I designed systems, I invented systems, and whatever. And I sold ideas within the company to the people inside the company. Could not manage to sell. So
could not manage to effectuate within the company.
They couldn't sell it to their own manager.
Yes.
Okay. And that's not because I was so god-awful smart or anything like that. It's just that I came in from a different direction. I came in from a different launching pad, a different experience. And so I generated a different kind of respect that they couldn't. Mm-hmm. Not that I was ever